The question, who am I, lies at the heart of every spiritual journey. Maybe an even better way to put this question is, who am I now? Because we know that that answer evolves as we go through our lives. Heck, we know the answer may actually change in one given day as we move through our variety of roles and identities. Who we are at home, or in the classroom, or the office, or the school, or the factory, or the pub, or the concert hall, or the fellowship, at the very least in these different settings, who we are takes on a different flavor. And I am convinced this question, who am I, is the hardest spiritual question of all. Questions like, is there a God? Do you believe in God? Do you believe in the afterlife? Those are easy compared to who am I. With God and the afterlife, we can wax philosophical, we can descend into concepts, we can be speculative. We can put on these outer garments that keep the depth of our soul ultimately hidden away. But who are you? There's no evading that question. It's like all those outer garments and the inner garments all are stripped away, and we stand there figuratively naked trying to figure out who we are beneath all of these layers. If we take this question seriously, there is no hiding. I think answering this question, who am I, takes a strong internal compass if we're going to answer it honestly and authentically. Part of the difficulty of answering this question is that it is very tempting to answer in the way that we think we're supposed to answer it. Society's conventions give us some very strong hints about how we're supposed to answer this question. So, for example, if we include man or woman in our self-identity, that can invite in all sorts of conventional understandings of what it means to be a man or a woman. Sure, there's been a remarkable loosening of the stranglehold of gender stereotypes in the last several decades. But still, these labels, man and woman, they pack a punch of conventional, narrow understandings. And if we allow these understandings to be part of how we answer this question, who am I, rather than being authentic to who we really are, then we're going to get nowhere in the spiritual journey. If you have a spiritual practice, and I hope that you do, and it's worth anything, then it will help you get beneath these kind of knee-jerk conventional responses to who am I. It'll get you in touch with your deepest core. If it doesn't do so, then I'd suggest that there's a good chance your practice is not deep enough. Or maybe it's too focused on things that maybe don't matter as much, like the existence of God or the afterlife. Or maybe this work of self-identity just is too hard, and this is just one more area of evasion from the question. And yes, this is a really hard question. At least it is for me. I take solace that some people who are a lot more spiritual than I am or ever will be, all the way up to Jesus and the Buddha, have really struggled with this question. And part of why I think this question, who am I, is such a difficult question is that many spiritual paths have at their heart a paradox about identity. The American Buddhist writer Jack Kornfield puts this really well in his book, A Path with Heart. There are two parallel tasks, he says, in the spiritual life. One is to discover selflessness, and the other is to develop a healthy sense of self. Both sides of that apparent paradox must be fulfilled for us to awaken. So I want to start with the healthy sense of self side. I think what we know is that self-negation is ultimately not very good for the soul. Feminism has emphatically made this point for decades. Feminism declared that too many women, for too long have been encouraged to surrender or negate who they are at the deepest level as part of their selfless love for others. Giving up yourself for your children, giving up yourself for your husband, this is what a good, virtuous woman is supposed to do in a sexist, patriarchal society. Give, 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 until sooner or later there's nothing left, until maybe your soul has dried up and blown away. After decades of giving, 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 a woman may no longer know who she is, besides being a handmaiden for children and men. She may have no idea of her inherent identity, her innate identity, other than these helping relationships. So feminism critiqued this dynamic of sexism and patriarchy, and it lifted up that everybody, not just men, but women too, everybody should develop a healthy sense of self. That's what makes people shine. A similar dynamic can play out in folks who are not part of the majority or dominant ethnic group. In slavery and in official Jim Crow segregation and unofficial post-Selma Jim Crow segregation, racism has attempted to program African Americans to negate themselves. So Jesse Jackson's "You Are Somebody" slogan was more than mere words. It is an important antidote to this racially enforced self-negation. "You are somebody" declares that we all have a fundamental goodness, regardless of what conventional society says about us, regardless of the color of our skin, or whether we're wearing a suit or a dress or a hoodie. This is what the granddaughter in No Mirrors in My Nana's House learned from looking at the only mirrors that existed in her Nana's house, that is, into her Nana's eyes. She looked into her Nana's eyes in that beautiful song we just heard, and she knew she was good. Inherently, wholly, completely good. She looked into her Nana's eyes, and she knew she was somebody. She knew she was beautiful. Looking into those mirrors, she knew that her skin was not too black, or her nose too flat, or her clothes too ill-fitting. So the lesson for all people, whether oppressed or privileged or somewhere in the middle, is don't look for a self-acceptance outside of yourself. Own who you are. Accept who you are. Love who you are. And allow other people to be who they are. And then, and only then, can you tackle the other half of Cornfield's paradox. That reality that you are selfless, that ultimately there is no there, there in your soul. The Buddhist psychiatrist and meditation teacher Jack Engler puts it well when he says, you must be somebody before you can be nobody. So the Buddhist insight is that ultimately everything, even the soul, is impermanent. Certainly self-identity is impermanent. Our self-understanding changes through our lives. We know that. How I answered the question, who am I, when I was 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 or now close to 50, well, it's changed. It's really changed over those years. And then, of course, sooner or later, we all die. That's kind of the exclamation point of impermanence, as Buddhists see it. So all self-identity is ultimately temporary, ultimately transient. And there's another aspect to this Buddhist understanding that ultimately we have no self that resonates with me as a Unitarian Universalist. And that is that we are so thoroughly interrelated with the people around us and the world around us, this whole web of life, that ultimately we're really not a separate being. We are completely interdependent. So to pretend there is some distinct separate entity called Roger is ultimately a fiction. It's impossible to disentangle Roger from all these webs of connection. This is a radical statement of interdependence. So, I am somebody. I am nobody. Both statements are true. Understanding this, deeply understanding this, is at the heart of the Buddhist path. Cultivate a healthy sense of self, and then realize that no self is permanent or separate from all else. Be somebody, then be nobody. And then the Buddha taught, translate that dual reality into the way you live your life. So what can help us in answering this question, who am I? Well, I find it helpful to realize as I answer this question that my answer is likely to be fluid and multiple. I love the passage Jason shared from Walt Whitman in his usual, you know, exuberant style. He declares, I am large. I contain multitudes. We are all large. We all contain multitudes. We are all complicated people. And it's impossible to give a narrow, once and for all answer to the question, who am I? There's just too much change in life for that to make any sense. I also find it helpful in answering this question to unleash my imagination. For me, that works a lot better than looking around at society for cues about how I'm supposed to answer this question. I'm reminded of a TV show I saw long ago, early in the AIDS crisis. The show was about a young man who was dying of AIDS. And this was back in the mid-80s, maybe, when everybody who had AIDS would die. And when in this country it overwhelmingly hit gay men. And I don't remember the name of the movie or the actors in it or even much about the plot. But I remember this one line. If my memory serves me correctly, the line was delivered by the father of this young man after he died. The father is talking with his son's grieving partner, and he's lamenting how he let society's homophobia sabotage his relationship with his son, rather than following his true heart and opening his arms toward his son and his son's partner. He shut them out. He rejected them. And then, in a flash, his son was gone. So sitting at a table talking with his son's partner, the father identifies the core of the mistake he made. He said, my mistake was a colossal failure of imagination. He could not imagine a world where straights and gays alike are accepted and embraced for who they are. He could not imagine where straight people and gay people alike can give their hearts in marriage to one another. He could not imagine a world where men and women were released from the chains of Ozzie and Harriet and Leave It to Beaver. He could not include gay in his understanding of his son's identity, and he could not include parent of a gay child in his own self-identity. Sitting there talking with his son's partner, he realized what a horrendous price he and his son's partner paid for this failure of imagination. So when I answer this question, who am I? I want to unleash my imagination, and I want to help other people unleash theirs. In answering this question, who am I? I also find it really helpful to be careful about labels. Now, labeling is inherently part of how we answer this question. And in general, self-applied labels can be helpful if we use them wisely, hold them lightly, and constantly question their validity. But slapping labels on other people, not so helpful to them in answering this question. Most of the time when we slap a label on someone else, we put a lot of assumptions along with it. Assumptions that it can effectively function as a kind of prison for this other person. Worse, labeling can be, of course, a form of putting someone down. Ultimately, it can even be an excuse to kill. Think about Nazi concentration camps, the ultimate form of labeling someone. In fact, you actually had to wear a label when you were imprisoned in a concentration camp. Red triangle meant you are a liberal, a communist, a socialist, or a Freemason. A green triangle meant you were a professional prisoner. Pink triangle, sexual offender, which is how the Nazis ignorantly characterized all gay men. Brown triangle, Roma or Gypsy. The list goes on. A double triangle badge meant that you were labeled Jewish. Yellow meant you were standard Jewish. Pink double triangle meant you were Jewish and gay. This is the horrific endpoint of this game of labeling other people in order to hate and to persecute. So when it comes to labeling other people, I kind of have a simple golden rule, and that is that I will only use the labels that they want to have used for themselves. I'll only use the labels that they own in their self-definition. And this generally keeps me from using labels to imprison other people. So let's take an example. Someone who does not identify as a heterosexual person. Not so many years ago, non-heterosexual people were generally labeled homosexuals. At least that was the label generally used in so-called polite company. Now, it generally had an undertone, or maybe more than an undertone, of derision to it. Homosexuals were viewed as odd, deviant, abnormal, etc. Some folks continue to fling the homosexual label on other people today, mostly, I think, to try to keep alive those negative connotations. Not surprisingly, given all that, this is not a label that is widely embraced by non-heterosexual people. Got too much baggage of oppression. It also covers such a wide array of self-identities that it doesn't really make sense anyway. So non-hetero folks today are claiming a wide variety of other labels that are much more imaginative and not oppressive. Labels like lesbian, gay, bi, trans, tranny, queer, genderqueer, genderbender, third sex, the list goes on. Some of these are more specific, some are more general. Let's think about the label queer for a moment. Of course, queer was once upon a time a nasty, negative label slapped on other people whose gender or sexual identity was perceived to be different or weird. But now, it is a label embraced by many people who do not view themselves as heterosexual or heteronormative. Why is this? Well, some people embrace it as a political act. They are reclaiming or reappropriating a term that had been used derisively, but they're redefining it, owning it, in the same way that some Wiccan women now are owning and redefining the word witch, reclaiming it. Some folks embrace this queer label because it is more ambiguous and nonspecific, reflecting uncertainty, blurriness, or fluidity in their self-understanding of sexuality and gender. It's a label that does break out of this binary gender rigidity where you're either male or female and everything's cast in stone. So I wanted to share one person in the fellowship who self-identifies as queer. Uses it because she is someone who has partnered with men, with women, and with people who identify as genderqueer or transgender. She isn't straight. She isn't bi because she doesn't subscribe to this gender binary viewpoint. And she's not a straight-up lesbian due to the fact that she's had some partners who aren't women. So queer, to her, feels like it fits better. In her book about being married to a trans person, Helen Boyd, who works at Lawrence and lives in Appleton with her wife husband, who she calls Betty in the books, Helen writes about why she identifies as queer. For me, she writes, being queer has come to mean that no one gets to tell me what to call what I and Betty do. No one gets to tell me what I'm doing is wrong, because queer is already wrong. It takes it outside of categories that restrict and define me. So with my golden rule about labeling, I'll use queer to describe someone if that's a word they use to describe themselves. If there's another label they prefer, great, I'll use that. The basic principle underlying this is they get to decide, I don't get to decide for them. So this is why I wanted to use the word queer in the information about the woman that we sent out this last week who we've selected to be our new assistant minister, starting in August. Queer is a word that Leah Hart Landsberg uses to describe herself. So it made sense to me to use that word. This, though, leads me to another caveat about using words and labels to define other people. It's important to realize that any of these labels is always partial. One of the things that drives queer or LGBTQ people crazy is the assumption that these labels totally define a person, as if this label tells you everything you need to know about someone. Who you are attracted to or how you understand your gender or your sexuality, yeah, that's an important part of anyone's life, but it's not the only important aspect in a person's life. Queer no more captures the whole of Leah than straight captures the whole of me. One more thing I want to lift up that can help us in this asking this question, who am I, is being part of a community that accepts our answer. Being part of a community that accepts our answer rather than reinforcing societal conformity to this question. This is why, to me, religions which promote conformity to society's answer of this question can be so negative and detrimental. We opened our service with this beautiful hymn, "I Know This Rose Will Open." Well, this rose may not open if the way it's open that's true to me is not going to be welcome or accepted. So here at the Fellowship, we try to be a place of radical hospitality where we accept people as they truly are. And when we succeed in this, the Fellowship can become a safe, creative, imaginative, embracing place for people to answer this question, who am I? And this can become a place in which we look into each other's eyes and feel embraced and loved for who we are, where we can look into one another's eyes and see reflected back beauty, radiance, our true essence. If that's the case here, if we can do that, then this is a place that can change the world. So how might I answer this question, who am I? I am Roger. I am somebody. I am nobody. I'm a human being. I'm a man. I'm a gentleman. I'm a man who doesn't swear or use power tools or care much about cars. I'm the husband of Amy. I'm the father of Hattie and Ian. I'm the son of Marcia and Chuck. I'm the brother of Judy and Chuck and Ken and Mike. I am a minister. I am more than a minister. I am a Unitarian Universalist. I am a liberal. I am a straight person, as long as you know this label is not a straitjacket of conformity, blandness, or 100% hetero identity. I'm related to everything. I'm embedded in nature. I'm an American citizen. I'm a world citizen. I'm the product, along with, as of a couple days ago, 7,003,859,741 other human beings. I'm a product of an amazing combination of physics and evolution and, dare I say, luck. A chain of events going back some 13 billion years had to happen in exactly the way it happened for me to be here. One badly placed meteor or a poor decision by an ancestor like, let's take the Titanic across the oceans. And I might have been a wasn't. One day I will be a wasn't. I'm a miracle.